AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. Today, we're really getting into a pretty unique story. Imagine this. Your whole childhood, basically from age 11 onwards, is tied to, well, one of the most loved characters in modern fiction, Ron Weasley. So what actually happens after that? When your world's been defined by Harry Potter, how do you go about building your own identity? You know, a career with different sides to it, a life beyond the robes. That's what we're diving into today. Our mission, really, is to give you a full picture of Rupert Grint's journey. We'll look at everything his surprisingly normal childhood dreams, that very unconventional addition, then the whole decade in the spotlight. And then, crucially, his path after Potter, how he deliberately tried different things, film, TV, even theater. Place we'll touch on his personal life, his charity work, and, yeah, even the slightly tricky subject of his finances. The aim is for you to get a really rounded view of the man himself.
Exactly. And for this deep dive, we're mainly drawing from a pretty detailed biography. It's packed with info. Seriously, it covers his acting milestones, what critics thought, some great personal stories that show his character, and yeah, even the complex stuff like his tax dealings. It gives us this fascinating look at someone whose life just exploded into the public eye so young and how it's kept developing in, well, often quite surprising ways.
Right. So let's start right back at the beginning then. Rupert Alexander Lloyd Grint. Born August 24th, 1988, in Harlow, Essex. He's the eldest of five kids. His dad, Nigel, dealt in racing memorabilia, and his mum, Joanne. He grew up in Watnet Stone, Hertfordshire. Now you'd maybe think, future global movie star, must have dreamed of acting, right? But the charming thing is, his big ambition. It wasn't acting, he wanted to be an ice cream man. Seriously.
Yeah, it's a great little detail, isn't it?
And he actually did it. Later on, with his Harry Potter money, he bought an ice cream van, drove around selling ice cream to locals, fulfilled the dream.
That ice cream van story, it's more than just cute, though. I think it says a lot. It points to this kind of desire for something normal, maybe simple joys, which is such a huge contrast to the insane global fame that was about to hit him. And it brings up that big question, really. How does anyone, especially a kid, keep hold of who they are when they're suddenly thrown into this massive public kind of weird life? That dream almost feels like an anchor, you know, something tying to a more ordinary world.
Yeah, you can sort of see that desire for normalcy in his background, too. He went to Richard Hale School in Hertford, was raised Catholic, apparently feared God as a kid, which suggests a pretty standard upbringing. Sure, he liked theater at school, did some plays, joined the Top Hat stage in screen school, played a fish in Noah's Ark, a donkey in the Nativity, classic school play stuff. But the key thing, he had zero professional acting experience before Potter. None. He even left school at 16. Said he didn't really like school that much. Just sounds like a pretty regular kid, completely unprepared for what was coming.
Absolutely. And that context just makes his leap even more incredible. From school plays to, well, a multi-billion-dollar franchise, it's almost unheard of. It really highlights the gamble the casting directors took, maybe. Or perhaps it shows there was just something inherently right about him, something you can't teach. An authenticity, maybe.
Authenticity. Yeah, that leads perfectly into the audition story.
Yeah.
So casting for Philosopher's Stone kicks off in 1999. J.K. Rowling famously wanted an all-British cast. Grint, who was actually a fan of the books already, sees a report on Newsround about the open casting, decides to go for Ron. And this is where it gets brilliant. Instead of doing a normal audition piece, what does he do? He sends in a video of himself rapping. Rapping about why he should get the part.
Can you imagine the sheer nerve of it?
Exactly. It's so unique, so unexpected, just this burst of personality, and it worked. The casting team noticed it. It stood out from probably thousands of tapes, and they called him in.
Such a bold move.
Totally. And in August 2000, boom, he's cast. Alongside Daniel Radcliffe and Emma Watson, the famous trio. And a little trivia bit, he's actually the oldest of the three. People often don't realize that.
It's legendary for a reason, that story. And the insight, I think, is that sometimes just being yourself, even in a quirky way, can cut through more than polished technique. Especially when they're looking for someone with natural charm, which Ron definitely needed. He wasn't trying to be someone else. He just put his enthusiasm out there in his own way. And that raw passion, that distinctiveness, it was obviously exactly what they wanted. It's a good reminder, maybe, that taking the unconventional path can really pay off.
So there he is, Rupert Grint, the aspiring ice cream man who rapped his way into playing Ron Weasley. And then for 10 solid years, his life was Ron Weasley. He grew up playing that character, all 8 Harry Potter films. Starting with Philosopher's Stone in 2001, right through to Deathly Hallows Part 2 in 2011. That's basically his entire adolescence on screen.
It's an immense undertaking. Think about it, holding onto a character and your own identity across 10 years, 8 massive films, during your most formative time. It's an extraordinary amount of pressure. Growing up personally, growing professionally, all while the whole world is watching. Just keeping the enthusiasm going, keeping the character fresh, dealing with the fame, the travel, the filming demands. It takes a kind of resilience we probably don't even think about.
Let's track that journey a bit, film by film. See how he evolved. Philosopher's Stone, 2001, his big screen debut. And it was huge, right? Smash box office records, highest grossing film of the year, nearly $1 billion. Critics mostly liked it, though some felt it stuck maybe too closely to the book. But for Grint, instant recognition. He won a Satellite Award for Outstanding New Talent, a Young Artist Award for Most Promising Young Newcomer, straight out of the gate.
Yeah, that must have been completely wild. Thrilling, but maybe terrifying too. Going from literally no professional acting to winning awards overnight, it set the bar incredibly high. But it also showed the casting wasn't just luck. They saw something real in his performance. That raw, sort of untutored energy he had was perfect for Ron in that first film, that amateurish ardor someone mentioned.
Then Chamber of Secrets in 2002, also well-received. Critics liked the leads again. And interestingly, papers like the LA Times and New York Magazine pointed out the trio were maturing. New York Magazine specifically said Grint was more proficient, although they kind of missed that raw quality from the first film, that amateurish ardor from him and Emma Watson.
That observation is really telling, isn't it? It shows how quickly they were learning on the job. It's natural, that shift from pure instinct to more technique. For Grint, this film let him dig a bit deeper into Ron, especially with things like the spiders, his arachnophobia, which apparently is a real fear for Grint too. So reacting convincingly to Aragog, a giant CGI spider, needed more than just enthusiasm. It showed he was developing the skills to really embody the character in these big fantastical scenes.
2004, Prisoner of Azkaban. Big change here with Alfonso Cuarón directing. Definitely a darker tone. The kids are on the brink of adolescence, facing much more serious stuff. Oddly, it's the lowest grossing Potter film, still made nearly $800 million, mind you, and was the second biggest film of 2004, but lower than the others.
Cuarón definitely brought a different feel. More introspective, maybe moodier, and that pushed the actors, I think. For Grint, it meant exploring Ron's loyalty, his anxieties, with a bit more weight. It wasn't just reacting to magic anymore, it was about the emotional impact of it all. That kind of direction probably forced him to find deeper nuances in Ron, needing real character work, not just saying the lines, a crucial step for any young actor. The box office dip doesn't really diminish its importance in their development.
Okay, on to Goblet of Fire in 2005. Mike Newell directing this one. More romance creeping in, more humor too. Grint apparently said Newell was really loud and swore a bit, but really cool. Sounds like maybe a looser vibe on set. He and the others actually said in an interview that the humor was a big part of its success, and critically, one of the best reviewed of the series, praised for being more mature, sophisticated, darker plot, good writing, great performances.
This one was a big turning point for Ron's character, definitely. He's dealing with all that teenage stuff, insecurity, jealousy, especially around Hermione and the Yule Ball. And Grint really had to navigate that, the awkwardness, the sort of simmering romance, the frustration, but also lean into the humor. It really showed his range expanding. It wasn't just magic. It was the very human stuff of growing up, just, you know, amplified by the wizarding world. His portrayal of Ron's vulnerability here made the character even more relatable, I think. Showed he could handle that emotional complexity.
Film 5, Order of the Phoenix, 2007. David Yates takes over as director, and he sticks around for the rest of the series. Huge hit financially, set a massive worldwide opening weekend record. Grint said Yates was really good, liked his laid-back style, felt it kept things fresh. Shows how that director relationship matters. And this was the year they did the handprints, footprints, and wand prints at Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood, properly cemented in film history.
Having Yates provide that consistent direction for the last 4 films must have been beneficial. A stable environment for them to keep growing. And yeah, that Grauman ceremony is more than just publicity, isn't it? It's a real marker of their cultural impact, a permanent acknowledgement of their work over that decade. Pretty profound.
Then Half-Blood Prince in 2009, another box office monster, over $930 million. Very well reviewed, too. People liked the emotionally satisfying story, the look, the feel of it. And Grint himself noticed a shift in Ron, said his character was becoming more secure, less defined by just being insecure, but also showing a darker edge as things got serious. He actually said it was fun to personify a more emotional Ron. Shows he was really engaging with the character's journey, got a few award nominations for it too.
That development for Ron was key. Moving him beyond just the funny best friend, it let Grint show more depth, hinting at the maturity needed for the really heavy final films. You know, actors can get stuck in a role in a long series, so getting meatier emotional arcs is vital, keeps them challenged, stops it getting stale.
Yeah.
This film really let him demonstrate that complexity.
Right, the grand finale. Split into two parts. Deathly Hallows Part 1 in 2010, Part 2 in 2011. Apparently, the main actors had some initial thoughts about whether to sign on again, which is understandable. It was a huge commitment. But Grint was on board by March 2007. Splitting the last book made sense financially and for the story. They shot them back to back. Finally wrapped in June 2010. Must have been intense. Part 1 did incredibly well. Over 950 million. Good reviews, mostly. And Grint's performance really got noticed here. Dana Stevens at Slate said all three leads were terrific. Joe Morgenstern at the Wall Street Journal didn't even like the film much, but wrote specifically that Grint has grown up to be a skillful actor who knows the value of a slow burn. High praise. Got nominations from MTV and the National Movie Awards too. Best Fight, Performance of the Year. So, recognized by critics and audiences.
That phrase, skillful actor, is huge. It really validates that whole decade of learning on camera. Mm-hmm. Shows a clear progression from novice to well accomplished. And slow burn suggests subtlety, control. A long way from that initial amateurish ardor. It means he could deliver understated but powerful moments. Proof he genuinely honed his craft through that intense experience. He didn't just grow up, he grew as an actor.
And Part 2 in 2011 picks up the pace, more action-focused, critically acclaimed, Grint included. Anne Hornaday at the Washington Post had that great line, "Who could have predicted that Radcliffe, Grint, and Watson would turn out to be good actors?" Box office was insane. Biggest midnight release, biggest first day, biggest opening weekend. Ended up as the fourth highest grossing film ever at the time. And for Grint, the end was obviously massive, he said. I mean, it literally has been my childhood.
Yeah, I remember reading that quote.
And suddenly it all came down to really just one random scene, jumping through a fireplace, and then it was over. He said it was very odd, really emotional, realizing they'd never do it again. And J.K. Rowling herself, at the premiere, called him one of the big seven cast members, acknowledged how vital he was.
It's fascinating, isn't it, how he, like Ron, visibly grew up on screen. And the critics noticed that growth, especially later on. The challenge is immense. Keeping it fresh, staying enthusiastic, developing the character over 10 years, especially when you're so young and so identified with that role. Grint managed it by letting Ron grow with him. His later performances felt really personal, and they got that critical recognition. You know, looking at other child actors in long franchises, it's quite rare to see that consistent validation for their acting evolution and their ability to sort of separate themselves from the character while still honoring it.
So what's the takeaway on Grint here? He literally matured before our eyes. From that raw enthusiasm to being called a skillful actor? That's a massive journey, especially under that constant global spotlight. And you have to wonder, how does spending your entire youth so deeply immersed in a fictional world affect you? Your sense of self? Your future plans? It definitely adds a layer to understanding the choices he made next, trying to define himself outside of Hogwarts. Okay, so while Potter was still massive, Grint was already starting to look beyond it. Testing the waters, you could say.
Which is smart. Yeah. Very smart. The danger of being typecast after a role that huge is massive. So doing other projects, even small ones, while Potter was still going, it was a way to signal to people, hey, I can do other things, explore different genres, get different experiences, basically building a non-Potter CV before it all ended. That kind of thinking is crucial for staying relevant long term.
His first film outside Potter was way back in 2002, actually, Thunderpants. He co-starred as Alan, a boy who can't smell, who's friends with another kid who has, let's say, extraordinary flatulence issues.
Right.
Yeah. Critics pretty much hated it. One review was brutal. This film should be shown in prison so that inmates have a good reason to never return.
Wow. Okay. Well, you can't knock him for trying something different, I guess. I mean, going from this huge fantasy blockbuster to that. It's certainly a choice. Maybe it was just for fun. A way to do something completely silly, away from the Potter intensity. Or maybe just a chance to work without that immense pressure. Even if it didn't land critically, it shows he wasn't afraid to experiment, you know? Didn't take himself too seriously, perhaps. That can be valuable for a young actor, too.
Fast forward to 2006, he does Driving Lessons. It's a comedy drama, and he stars opposite Julie Walters, Molly Weasley herself.
Interesting pairing.
Yeah.
The film got mixed reviews overall, but Grint's performance as this sort of oppressed teenage boy, Ben, was widely praised. Andre Sors at Alt Film Guide called him a revelation, said he had this innate naturalness mixed with personal charisma that made the character really likable and funny, despite being potentially quite awkward, and that seems significant. Co-star from Potter, totally different vibe, and he gets singled out for praise like that, showed there was definitely more to him than Ron.
Working with Julie Walters again probably helped, created a comfortable space for him to...
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Maybe take more risks. And getting that kind of specific critical acclaim, being called a revelation, that's huge. It wasn't just, oh, Ron's in another film. It was validation that he could act, genuinely act in a different register. Proved he could handle nuance, charm, vulnerability in a grounded, non-magical role. A really key step in shaking off the typecasting potential.
Then in 2009, he went darker with Cherry Bomb, a drama with Robert Sheehan and Kimberly Nixon. He played Malachi, a guy who gets obsessed with his boss's daughter, and it leads to violence. Pretty different territory. Grin himself said it was very different from shooting Potter much faster pace, like a dozen scenes per day.
Oh.
His first real go at something more intense, more adult.
And what's really interesting about Cherry Bomb is the fan involvement. It premiered at the Berlin Film Festival in 2009, but struggled to get a distributor. Happens a lot with indie films. But then Grin's fans launched this online campaign, and it actually worked. They helped secure a UK distribution deal in 2010.
Wow, really?
Yeah. It makes you wonder, doesn't it? How much does that kind of massive early fan base actually help an actor diversify? Not just by watching the films, but by actively fighting for them. It's a pretty powerful example of fan loyalty making a tangible difference.
Definitely. Okay, then Wild Target in 2010. Comedy thriller, remake of a French film. Starred with Emily Blunt and Bill Nighy.
DeCap.
Yeah, but it didn't do well. Small budget, made even less back. Mostly negative reviews, too. But even in that, Grint still got some positive mentions. One critic said something like, nice to see him do well in a role that isn't Ron. He clearly has a career ahead of him. So even a flop didn't entirely bury his performance. And alongside all this, he was still popping up elsewhere. A cameo in Come Fly With Me on the BBC, got cast as the lead in a small Norwegian anti-war film, Into the White, based on a true story from 1940. That sounds intense. Did a fashion shoot with Tom Felton, Draco Malfoy for Band of Outsiders. Announced he was voicing Postman Pat.
Postman Pat, seriously.
Yeah, yep. And famously, he was in Ed Sheeran's Lego House music video in October 2011.
So these varied projects, often quite small, during the Potter peak years, they were just random gigs. It feels very strategic. Testing different genres, different mediums, indie drama, voice acting, music videos. Building that non-Potter identity piece by piece. He was actively showing his range before the safety net of Potter was gone. That's smart career planning, trying to ensure he wouldn't just disappear or be stuck as Ron forever.
Yeah, it's like he was laying the groundwork. So consider that. How important were those smaller, diverse roles during the height of Potter mania? Were they just keeping busy or a calculated strategy to prepare for the future? Seems like the latter. Okay, so Potter wraps up in 2011. Now Rupert Grint steps out properly on his own. And he didn't just focus on acting straight away. In 2012, he did other things too, like that Visit Britain TV ad with Julie Walters again, Misha Stockery, Stephen Fry, promoting UK holidays, using his profile.
Right, leveraging that recognizability.
And later that year, July 25th, he carried the Olympic torch for the London 2012 Games. Ran through Hendon, said it was overwhelming, amazing, felt really proud, a big national moment.
Yeah, that's significant, connecting himself to something beyond entertainment.
He also narrated a 3D planetarium film called We Are Aliens, about searching for life in the universe, diversifying again.
Looking at those things together, the tourism ad, the Olympics, the science narration, it shows a clear effort to broaden how people saw him. He wasn't just Ron Weasley, actor. He was engaging with national events, tourism, even science communication. It's a smart way to manage your public image, show different facets, move beyond the one defining role, signals maturation.
He also tried his hand at American TV pilots, In 2013, he was cast as the lead, Clyde, in a CBS comedy pilot called Super Clyde from Greg Garcia, who did My Name is Earl.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. But it didn't get picked up to become a full series, which happens, right? Shows the reality of the business. Even big names have projects that don't quite make it, part of the process.
Absolutely. The pilot graveyard is vast.
But then later in 2013, a really big move, his stage debut, West End, London. He was in Jez Butterworth's play Mojo, a black comedy. He played Sweets, described as a hoodlum who pops amphetamines like Smarties and has this comic menace.
Wow, quite a departure from Ron.
Totally. Gritty stuff, based on real events. Starred alongside some heavy hitters too, Brendan Coyle, Ben Whishaw, Daniel Mays. It ran for a few months at the Harold Pinter Theater. And for that role, he won the What's on Stage Award for Best London Newcomer. Big critical validation.
That's fascinating. Moving to theater, especially the West End, what does that signal? Often it's about actors wanting a different kind of challenge, right?
Well,
the immediate audience feedback, the sustained performance night after night, it's a real test of craft. For Grint, it was a bold choice, and winning an award for it straight off, that really cemented his credibility as a serious actor beyond film, proved he could handle that demanding environment.
And he didn't stop there. The next year, 2014, he went to Broadway, made his debut as Frank Finger in It's Only a Play.
Another big step.
Yeah, and look at this cast. Matthew Broderick, Nathan Lane, Stalker Channing, Megan Mullally. Seriously, high-profile company.
Wow, that's legendary status.
Ran for several months at the Gerald Schoenfeld Theater, and he won two Broadway.com Audience Choice Awards for it, Favorite Featured Actor and Favorite Breakthrough Performance.
Okay, so succeeding on both the West End and Broadway in quick succession, with audience awards too, that's impressive. It really speaks to his dedication, his talent. Broadway's tough, demands incredible stamina, presence. The audience award show, he really connected with people live, not just as Ron on screen. Huge validation.
He kept up the film work too, alongside the theater. Back in 2013, he was attached to this Macbeth adaptation called Enemy of Man, with Sean Bean, Charles Dance. Filming started in 2014. He played Ross in the concept trailer. Not sure if it got fully made, but interesting project. Also did Charlie Countryman in CBGB in 2013, then Moonwalkers in 2015, and more recently, a big one, M. Night Shyamalan's thriller Knock at the Cabin in 2023, played Redmond.
Yeah, that was a noticeable role.
And he's got another film called Nightborne in post-production, apparently, so keeping busy on screen. And television has become a really big area for him, very active, making interesting choices. He executive produced and starred in Snatch, the series based on the movie from 2017-18, so creative control there.
Right, stepping behind the camera, too.
Also starred in Sick Note, a black comedy, around the same time. Different kind of humor. Then played Inspector Chrome in the ABC Murders, the Agatha Christie adaptation in 2018. Classic detective stuff. And from 2019 to 2023, a major role as Julian Pierce in Servant on Apple TV, plus psychological horror, critically liked, ran for 4 seasons.
That consistent move into horror and psychological thrillers is really interesting. Servant, and he was also in an episode of Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities in 2022.
Oh, yeah. Dreams in the Witch House.
Exactly. It's a very clear, deliberate shift away from the family-friendly image. He's actively choosing darker, more complex roles. It challenges him, challenges the audience's view of him. It's a really effective way to carve out a distinct post-Potter identity, showing a much broader, often more intense acting range.
And amidst all that, he still embraces the past sometimes. He was in the Harry Potter 20th anniversary, Return to Hogwarts special in 2022.
Which was lovely to see.
Yeah. And then a fun little full circle moment. He starred in another Ed Sheeran music video for a little more in 2025, reuniting with Ed after Lego House way back in 2011.
Nice callback.
So when you look at his post-Potter career, it's this really deliberate mix, isn't it? Demanding stage roles, dark TV shows, interesting film parts, but also fun cameos that play with his image.
It's a masterclass in diversification, really.
How crucial is that for an actor trying to avoid being typecast forever, especially after a role as iconic as Ron? Grint's path seems like a pretty compelling example of how to do it, grow artistically, stay relevant, but also explore different interests. Okay, let's shift focus a bit. Beyond the acting, what about Rupert Grint, the person? Well, he seems to have built a pretty stable personal life. He's been with actress Georgia Groom since 2011. That's a long time.
Yeah, very grounded, it seems.
And they have 2 daughters now. Wednesday, born May 2020, and Goldie, born April 2025. So family life is clearly important, and here's a wild indicator of just how much people are still fascinated by him. He joined Instagram in November 2020, first post, a picture holding baby Wednesday. He hit 1 million followers in 4 hours and 1 minute. Broke the Guinness World Record for the fastest time to reach a million followers.
Wow, 4 hours. That's insane.
Right. It just shows this lasting connection people feel with him decades after Potter started. It's not just about the acting. There's this huge public affection.
That record isn't just trivia, is it? It really highlights that enduring bond he has with the audience, almost like family. It goes beyond just his roles. People are invested in him. And maybe that ties back to what we were saying earlier, despite the crazy fame. He seems to have kept this relatable, grounded quality that people really connect with, fosters that loyalty.
And speaking of groundedness, the ice cream van, we mentioned the dream, but he really did it. Bought the van with his Potter money, drove it around, sold ice cream, actually lived out that childhood ambition. It's brilliant.
It is brilliant. And it's quite rare, isn't it? Someone achieves that level of success and wealth, and what do? Buy an ice cream van. It's not about showing off. It's about connecting to something simple, maybe even nostalgic. It speaks volumes about staying grounded, holding on to a piece of that ordinary life. Makes it incredibly relatable. Shows a life not totally consumed by fame.
Away from whimsical vans, he's got normal interests too. Big football fan, supports Tottenham Hotspur. Very typical British passion. And as we mentioned, he got involved publicly with things like carrying the Olympic torch in 2012, a moment of national pride he was part of. He's also done a lot of charity work over the years, seems consistently committed, supported various charities, donated personal stuff for auctions. In 2010, he did that wacky rally with the Phelps twins, Fred and George, raising money for the RNLI, the Lifeboat Institution. Hands-on fundraising.
Good cause.
Yeah. Painted a butterfly for an eBay auction for Keach Hospice Care that same year. Got involved in the Make Mine Milk campaign in 2011, promoting drinking milk, ads on buses and everything. And since 2011, he's been a big supporter of Cancer Research UK's Little Star Award. He said something like, "It's wonderful they're helping to bring a little bit of magic to the children's lives."
That consistency is key, I think.
Okay.
It's not just one-off appearances. It's a pattern of engaging with different causes, emergency services, health, children's charities. It suggests a genuine personal connection, an understanding of the responsibility that comes with his platform and wealth, using it for positive impact. It really reinforces that image of him as a decent person, contributing beyond just his acting work, aligns his public image with, well, seemingly decent values.
So what does that consistent charity work tell you, the listener, about his values, how he uses his unique position? It definitely paints a picture of someone thoughtful and engaged. Right, let's move on to something a bit more complex, but definitely part of the story of fame and wealth, his tax affairs. Back in 2016, there was a legal case. Rupert Grint lost an appeal against HMRC, that's the UK tax authority. He'd tried to change his accounting date, apparently, to try and shift some income into a lower tax year, which would reduce his overall tax bill.
Okay, a common enough financial strategy or attempt at one.
Exactly. At the time, estimates put his Potter earnings around $24 million, so significant sums involved. But HMRC argued successfully that his main reason for changing the date wasn't a legitimate business need, but primarily motivated by tax avoidance. And that distinction matters legally.
Yeah, that's the crux of many of these cases, isn't it? Intent. It raises that tricky question. Where's the line between legitimate tax planning, which everyone does, and tax avoidance, which authority sees as bending the rules, even if not strictly illegal? The court sided with HMRC, deciding his primary motive was avoidance. It really highlights the intense scrutiny high earners, especially famous ones, are under. Tax authorities really dig into the why behind financial structuring. It's a complex area.
And it didn't end there. In 2019, HMRC brought another case against him. This time he lost again and was ordered to pay an extra £1.8 million in tax.
Ouch.
Yeah. The argument here was about how a specific payment of £4.5 million should be classified. Was it income or was it a capital asset? HMRC argued it was income. Grint's side presumably argued it was more like a capital gain. The difference in tax rates is huge. Income tax is usually much higher than capital gains tax.
Right. That classification is fundamental in tax law.
Exactly. HMRC won. The £4.5 million was treated as income, which massively increased his tax bill for the 2011-12 tax year. He lost his appeal and had to pay the £1.8 million plus legal costs.
So just to be clear here, for everyone listening, we're just reporting the facts from the source material about these legal outcomes. We're not taking sides or judging.
Absolutely not. It's about understanding the case as reported.
The core issue is that legal distinction between income money earned from work, essentially, and capital assets, things you own, like investments, that might increase in value. Taxed very differently. This ruling shows how aggressively tax authorities can challenge how large sums are categorized. And for public figures, these battles play out very publicly. It underlines the complex financial tightrope they walk.
Definitely. These cases really spotlight the intricate financial realities that come with big earnings and fame, and just how closely tax authorities are watching. It raises broader questions about financial planning for public figures, especially when their income is generated over many years from something like a huge franchise. It's a constant balancing act between legal management and public perception. Okay, so let's try and pull all these threads together. What does the whole picture of Rupert Grint tell us? It's clearly way more than just Ron Weasley made it big. It's a deep dive into figuring out your identity, managing ambition, dealing with the real world stuff that comes with such an unusual start in life. You know, from wrapping his way into the role to consciously choosing diverse parts in film, TV, and theater. His path has been fascinating. We've seen the grounded personal side, the consistent charity work, even the complexities of his finances. He's really navigated that transition from child star in an iconic role to becoming a versatile actor and, well, a seemingly well-rounded guy.
He really has. He's managed to build this varied career, always keeping that sort of relatable charm, but without being trapped by Potter. He still embraces a legacy, but isn't defined solely by it. His journey shows resilience, definitely. A willingness to try different things, maybe take risks, a quiet determination to do it his own way, often picking projects that seem to challenge him artistically, not just chasing fame. He's moved beyond being just the boy who lives best mate to become this multifaceted actor in person. Shows that huge early success doesn't have to dictate everything that follows. It can be a launch pad for something deeper, more intentional.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, maybe something for you, our listener, to think about. If your biggest achievement, the thing everyone knew you for, happened when you were really young, like it did for Rupert Grint, how would you define success for the rest of your life? And what steps would you consciously take to make sure your own growth, your own story, wasn't completely overshadowed by that early accomplishment? Something to mull over. Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive. We hope this look into Rupert Grint's journey gave you some food for thought and maybe a bit more insight into the man behind the magic.
Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.